Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, including all the archived shows. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. And if you don't know how to do that, just Google the word iTunes, take it from there, and you will find the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'd like now to welcome Robina Korten. She is a Tibetan Buddhist nun, has been doing that for over 25 years, and she is in town for the weekend teaching a course called Transforming Problems into Happiness. That's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday of this week at Body of Santa Fe. Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome. Very happy to be here again.
Yes, we had you on the show, I think, a couple of years ago.
Yep.
Curious about this, the title of the event, Transforming Problems into Happiness. How does that work?
Kind of tricky, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Well, I think in the Tibetan tradition, there's this really kind of, this really popular, but it's at the core of their approach to practicing, this approach that they call it in Tibetan Lojong, which really just means mind training. And the kind of the idea goes that, based on the idea that, you know, Buddha says we've all got this amazing potential, we can develop our qualities. And the thing that prevents our qualities from developing, you know, our good stuff, is all the unhappiness and the attachment and the anger and the fears and the nonsense. And so isn't it the best opportunity to work on your nonsense is when it comes up? And when does it come up? When you have problems. So, you know, it's like Lance Armstrong, I'm sure, is very happy to drive down the mountain, but he really probably cherishes going up the mountain because that's when he proves he's the best cyclist. That's when he becomes the best cyclist. Well, that's what transforming problems is. And so instead of being miserable when things go wrong, you practice, as Lama Zopa says, you learn to like ice cream. Learn to like problems like you like ice cream.
It's funny that you use that as an example because my personal relationship to things like athletics is, let's just start at the top of the mountain
and not and then go down.
Right. Because it's just too hard.
Yeah, well, there you go. I know. But I mean, the thing about problems is you don't have a choice, you know. I think no matter how hard we don't want them, I mean, look at our lives. Even if we're dealing with people in prison, and that's really problems. But we don't need to be imprisoned to have problems. I mean, just look at us. Every single day, the smallest thing can be a problem. So given that we've got them and they come on our head like rain, they're an amazing opportunity to really kind of see, you know, as we say, see it as a challenge.
So let's sort of walk through the process. Somebody comes in, make up a problem, or take one from one of your students.
Well, I mean, forget that. Just use my coffee, you know.
That's Charmaine, not a problem. It's a real problem.
But what's a real problem? You look at most of our lives. If you look at most of our lives and we sort of present a day, and we don't have many problems in what we understand. If I take one of my guys in prison, and it sounds like revolting, but it's all relative. But if you look at ordinary daily life for all of us, the smallest things can be you multiply those, and then eventually one becomes a straw that breaks the camel's back. So don't have to be all huge about it and talk about, you know, you're on death row and you shouldn't be, and I can tell you lots of examples of that. But even the smallest thing, and I think if you practice on the tiny things, I'm not kidding, really. I mean, let's just really be humble about it.
You know, okay, start with stomach pain.
Start with stomach. You mean a person gets a pain in their stomach?
Yes.
Or it's a chronic thing or what?
Yeah,
what
a person has chronic stomach pain.
Why can't we use an ordinary example, even before the
that
chronic?
That is an ordinary example.
But that's something, okay, whatever you like.
So how do you transform that into happiness?
Okay, finally, it comes down to how you see it, doesn't it? But I want to use my coffee.
Okay.
Ordinary example. You have an expectation, because we all know how we like things, right? So I know I like my coffee 180 degrees, and I like a double short shot, right? I like my coffee like that. So it's utterly miniature, of course it is. But as soon as you say, I want something a certain way, you're setting up the expectation that it'd be that way. So inevitably, as we all know, as soon as it doesn't come, then the mind gets unhappy. And I mean, it's a tiny one, and we just say, oh, well, that's ordinary life. But that's a perfect way to start practicing, a perfect way to start to accept that is how it is. And so for it to catch your mind and not let your mind get upset, that's what you do to transform a problem. It's a practical, technical thing. You learn to see your mind well, you catch the way you respond to something, and you change your response.
So catching it is a practice, and probably not that hard as time goes on.
As time goes on, like anything, it gets easier, but you've got to do it, you know.
But catching it is only step one.
Catching it, but it's a big one, because let's face it, most of us don't even know what's going on in our mind. I mean, we don't know we're angry until the words vomit out the mouth, you know. You don't know you're depressed if you just can't get out of bed one morning, because it's been accumulating over years, months, and days. And so this is the key, isn't it? You've got these practical techniques that Buddha has. I mean, he's really great at that, at learning to just start to focus your mind so you can begin to use that skill to see what the hell is going on inside.
So you some little disappointment or somebody cuts you off in traffic or whatever your little practice is. You catch yourself. I catch myself all the time, but then I haven't gotten to step two yet.
Well, that's it.
What is step two?
Step two is recognizing that actually that thing that you're calling a problem, when you really deconstruct it, and this is what we have to do. It's not just being intellectually clever. You really deconstruct that thing and you analyze what happened is. It's called a red light. It's called coffee a certain way. And these are the tiny things, and let's face it, that's most of our life. And once you do it with the tiny, you can do it with the big. And I'll give you some examples. You see that it's your interpretation of it. So most of the day, we are walking around full of interpretations, of viewpoints about how things are. But we don't think that. We see a person we don't like because, you know, let's say we don't like George Bush because he drops bombs on Iraq. Because we think, oh, well, that's moral. Therefore, we think I'm right to think he's a bad person. But we're not seeing that, yes, it's true. Killing people is wrong, and you can have that opinion. I mean, they say in Tibet, criticize the action, but you don't have to criticize the person. So we recognize as bombing in Iraq. It's true. If you had your little checklist of do's and don'ts, bombing people is not appropriate. But then what we do is we launch into anger, which is a very volatile, a strong opinion about a person who does it. And that's what causes us the suffering. I mean, that's what causes us to become agitated and depressed and upset and go and kill somebody else or whatever, you know. So that's a big example. But it's exactly the same with the coffee being wrong or the red light or the person saying the wrong word. We have an opinion about something. And when you really look at those opinions, it comes down to what you want, the way you want things to be. And this is a million times a day, you know.
It's a million times a day, and I think the ones that are very most difficult are the ones in which you or someone you love is disempowered in a very major way. The coffee is irrelevant. The people you work with, people on death row, people in prison, they have been disempowered. Their freedom has been taken away in a huge way, and their comfort has been taken away.
Exactly, all of this. So, but it's what's interesting, when I really look at this, from the point of view of my changing my mind and my becoming stable and my so-called transforming problems, the issue is identical. As to whether, you know, it's important that your coffee is hot or cold or whether somebody's on death row and they shouldn't be, okay, that's where you can have another discussion. But the point is, once we can begin to really break down the things that go on in our mind, I can learn to see that I can still retain stability and have a happy mind and be a happy, relaxed guy while continuing to work with people in prison or demonstrating against the bombing in Iraq.
No.
That is possible. And that means you just develop compassion on top of everything else, not just not care.
Grief and anger are natural human responses to the kind of thing we're talking about, especially the big things.
Sure.
When you practice Buddhism as long as you have, do you still go through those things, to experience those things?
Well, I mean, even let's look at the words natural human response. I mean, do you mean by that that something you're born with that you don't have a choice about? Is that what you mean by natural?
Well, sure. I mean, everybody grieves when the person they love most dies.
Yeah. But not everybody is angry.
That's probably
true.
Would
you agree with that?
I don't know. I mean, in this country, everybody seems to be.
But if you look at people, some people seem to be less angry than others.
Sure.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah,
I think that's true. Well, then
But anger does seem to be fairly universal
go.
I'm sure there's an endocrine component to it.
Well, as you know, the Buddha's deal is that there is mind and there is body. And they play an intimate role. I mean, you go to your Tibetan doctor, and they deal with the body as much as anything, as much as your doctor who will give you your serotonin boost. Your Tibetan doctor will feel your pulses, and he will notice that the wind energies are berserk. And so that particular set of wind energies that are berserk are impacting upon that certain part of your mind, which is not your body, which causes you to be anxious. So he'll give you you know, herbal medicine, which calms down your wind energy, which then gives you the space to change the anxiety. So the Buddhist approach is the wind energies or the chemicals, whatever you prefer to call it, is physical. But the depression, the anxiety, the anger, then that's not physical, that's mental. This is fundamental. This is sort of the fundamental one. So using that as your basis, then you learn to become familiar with the mental part, and that's, you know, a long-term job. And then you can learn to distinguish the two and realize even though you might have a chemical imbalance which can activate your depression, you know that your depression is a mental state, and then you learn through knowing your mind well to deconstruct it and see what it is and understand it and then change it, because it too is a viewpoint. I know it sounds kind of shocking, but this is the Buddhist approach. So whether it's anger or depression, they are these mental approaches. We could call them natural because most of us seem to have variations of them. But the thing is, the more you see your mind, the more you can deconstruct these very, very quick, seemingly just spontaneous responses, the more you can see that they are mental constructs. And because they're mental constructs, you can slowly, slowly change them, slowly see that they are viewpoints and you can change them. I know it's completely just seems to be the opposite of what we think in the West. But it's a bit cognitive therapy, I think. Buddha's a really kind of smart cognitive therapist.
We're talking to Robina Korten, who is here over the weekend teaching a course called Transforming Problems into Happiness. That's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at Body of Santa Fe. And we'll give phone numbers and all that kind of thing at the end of the show. It seems to me that there are some problems that dissolve when you do practices that are nonverbal, like meditation, and other things that require a kind of verbal, a conversation, talking about it. How do you, in the Buddhist tradition, how do you balance those things?
Well, it's just you're using your wisdom, you know. I mean, there's this lovely analogy that Buddha says, bird needs two wings, wisdom and compassion. So the wisdom side is what we're talking about right now, learning to see your own mind really well. So if I'm in a relationship with you, and you know, we're having a discussion about something, it's very reasonable for us to discuss it. There's nothing wrong with that, especially if it's an issue. Let's say we're trying to work together on a particular thing that's got to get done. Well, it makes sense to work through it by discussing. But I can't escape looking at my mind first. I can't escape seeing my part of the deal, seeing my own stubbornness or my own anger or my determination to get my way or whatever. I've got to see my part of it. I've got to really see myself incredibly well. I mean, this is the sneaky part. I think we're very tricky with ourselves and don't like to see what we're thinking. So if I can really take responsibility for my bit, then I'm going to be flexible. I'll listen to you. I'll hear you without just freaking out. And I'll be able to be a bit flexible and we can get the conclusion, you know.
You, as a Tibetan nun, having practiced for 25 years or more, you have a lot to draw on. But I wonder also whether it doesn't sometimes make it harder to see your own role in it because you think that you're more advanced than everybody else. In a disagreement, for example.
No, I understand. I don't think I'm more advanced than anybody else. I can't imagine. I mean, I'm pretty arrogant, but I don't think that thought. I never think that thought, I have to say.
I wonder if that's an occupational hazard of spiritual teachers.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I think about this a lot. I think about the Dalai Lama, for example. It's sort of evident to people that he's kind of charismatic, powerful. He's really one of the best scholars you're going to find. He's considered one of the greatest yogis you're going to find. He is considered the top, you know. So the thought goes, like what you said, well, he surely knows he's the best. But all I can say is, when I see him...
But the moment you know you're the best, you're not the best.
Well, that's exactly right. So the moment you see him with people in tears of compassion daily, you know, for his people in Tibet... His incredible humility with every single person who gets to see him. All the people I've known who've interviewed him, who've done stories on him, who've met him, who've been police, who've guarded him. Everybody just says he's the kindest, funniest, most practical, compassionate, ordinary person they've ever met, you know. So you have to say, even though you can be... Okay, that's something interesting. I remember years and years ago, before I was a Buddhist even, I remember watching on the television in Australia a program, and it was interviewing... I remember two of the people was an Australian cricketer called Don Bradman, who's sort of like America's Babe Ruth, but in cricket. And Dame Margot Fonteyn. I was a real ballet freak when I was a little girl, right? And she was my great hero. Now, they were the peak in their business. And it struck me then that there they were, these two people, the best. But they were unbelievably humble, unassuming, and everybody adored them. So it seems to me, just by looking, you can tell some people are the best. But if you've got real humility, and that also means confidence, you know. I think humility and confidence go together. I can see that. Because I think when it's pride or arrogance... Well, this is the Buddhist deal, okay? All the unhappy states of mind are completely linked to the neurotic sense of self, and they're all based in fear. So arrogance, if we can say arrogance is the expression of a negative one, it's an overinflated sense of your importance, which means you're self-consciously caught up in your own sense of self. But I can see with Bradman and Margot Fonteyn, they were unself-conscious. And therefore they could see others. They had a sense of interconnectedness. Therefore they could always appreciate everybody else. And therefore, I think that's why you can be the best, without arrogance.
What about when you're not the best? What about when you're just an ordinary person bumbling through your life and trying to use these teachings? Yeah. You know you're not the best at anything, and you never will be.
Right. I think that's... I know when I did Kung Fu, that was the way we were taught, that you didn't compare with others, ever, because that's arrogance, and that's all low self-esteem, one way or the other, isn't it? You're always comparing with others, and you always... Therefore, being arrogant if you think you're the best, or completely want to kill yourself if you think you're the worst. But that very view is an ego-based view. Whereas I know when we studied Kung Fu, we were competing against ourselves. So you learn to be, and I can see that in my own life, you learn to be content with who you are, because you're comparing with yourself. You're referencing where you are today with what you did yesterday, not others. As soon as you're comparing with others, that's the ego-based one, and that's set up for suffering. It's completely suffering.
It's interesting because in the United States, especially, the center of global capitalism, competition is considered a very positive value.
Yep.
Is there a positive role for competition?
Competition, I think, no problem. I want to, again, give a basis. The whole Buddhist one is you've got these positive states of mind and you have negative states of mind. It's very simple. Buddha's model of the mind is quite simple, really. And as I said before, the very nature of the ones that are called negative is that they're completely connected to this unhappy, miserable, neurotic, fearful sense of self, which we all think is normal and natural because we're all born with it. But this is Buddha's deal. He says,
we're born with it?
We're born with it. Oh, we've had it since beginningless time, he says. But he says we can get rid of it. And that's the basis of all the Buddhist practice, the assumption that the neuroses aren't innate to you. This is his point. Right?
Well, hang on. You're born with it, and yet it's not innate?
Well, your mind goes back since beginningless time, remember? Buddha says, doesn't he? And you come fully programmed into this life. I mean, Hitler didn't get made
because
by
of your karma.
Karma just means what you've done in the past leaves imprints in your mind, which is not rocket science. You know, you practice piano every day. You keep getting better at it. That's karma. Karma is just the process of habit. You do something, and you get better at it. So we can... Well, you can't just jump in on that. We can say it, and we can come back to it. It doesn't matter. What was I saying? What was the point before?
Well, let's go back to a fundamental question. We're talking to Robina Korten, Tibetan Buddhist nun who's visiting us in Santa Fe. What are the fundamental teachings, not so much in practice, but in theory, the philosophical teachings of the Buddha?
Okay. You know, this little packaging of the teachings called the Four Noble Truths is a really good one to present. And the third one, and I don't know why he didn't do that one first. I would do that one first. I'd do that one first, because I think we need to hear it in the West. He's saying, you know what, people, you can be free of suffering. You can be fully developed. So basically he's saying that mind, or consciousness, and you can say these words are used synonymously for Buddha, has the innate potential to be fully developed, very simply, in what we call the positive qualities. And you don't need to be a rocket scientist to know those. Love, compassion, kindness, empathy, all these words. He says they're innate to the mind. And that the other stuff, the ego, the fear, the fears, the depression, anxiety, anger, jealousy, this stuff, they are not at the core of our being. And this is fundamental. I mean, and already this is quite radical and a bit shocking, because you look at all the models of the mind that we think about in our culture. I think it's an absolute given that they're normal, they're natural, we're born with it, and therefore you make your most, you don't try to get rid of them. I mean, you go to your therapist and you say, I'd like methods, please, to get rid of all attachment, all anger, all jealousy. They'll think you're a bit
nuts.
They'll think you're nuts and give you a pill, honestly. So this is really the starting point for the Buddha. And I think to think about this first, because it's the very basis of wanting to even do something. If you really do believe that anger is innate, then why would you try to change it? You know, why would you? and then...
Well, you might want to just control it. You might want to manage it, as they say.
It's true, and that's good, better than nothing. But it's kind of an interesting point to think that you don't need to have it at all. And this is the starting point for the Buddha. So, okay, if it's true, and I'm prepared to give him a go here, you know, because you don't believe what Buddha says, he says, don't believe a single word he's telling you, take it as a hypothesis, you know, and prove it for yourself. So then if it's true, I can be free of suffering. I need to know what suffering is, and that's the first noble truth. So then he goes into great detail about exactly what it is and deconstructs it and analyzes it. Then the second one, and the key is the key, really, it's what are the causes of it. Because if you want to get rid of it, you've got to know the causes. So that's where...
So when we... sticking with what suffering is for a second, yeah. We can't go on to the 90-day dissertation on what suffering is, but it's not just a punch in the stomach.
Okay.
Or physical pain.
There are three kinds. The first kind is that one. The first level is what he calls the suffering of suffering, kind of in-your-face suffering, and that's what we all agree on. But the second one, we don't even call it suffering. It's a bit depressing initially. The second one, he calls it just the suffering of change. But that's what we mean by happiness. And that's where you really get into the details about how, if you look at the causes, you look at his fundamental principle about the long-term cause of suffering and then the short-term, which is, and they both subsume down to that, and that is, he says, this consciousness of ours is the continuity of mental moments, doesn't come from mummy, daddy, doesn't come from a creator, and doesn't come from nothing, and isn't physical. So you take all this as your hypothesis, and then you have this mind that goes back and back and back. It can't just come out of nowhere, which means, according to the Buddha, that you came into... So then, okay, that's one, the mind, your consciousness. Then he says, every split second in what you say and do and think, which he calls a karma, an action, leaves an imprint in your mind, or a seed. Like a habit, the propensity. And so that's, we program ourselves basically by what we do, say, and think. So really Buddha's saying we're like the creators of ourselves. So he's saying we come programmed into this life. Hitler wasn't made by his mummy. I mean, good God, poor old Austrian housewife, don't blame her, you know. Hitler came programmed with what he was. So did Mozart, so do all of us. So we start with that in this life, and then we learn to see that the negative stuff in me is not innate, thank God. The positive, I can grow. And so that's the basis of my wanting to then look into my mind, use these marvelous techniques he's got that he took from the Hindu, you know, the Hindus thousands of years ago, to learn to see my mind well, to distinguish between the positive and negative. But, I mean, we're talking real deep level. We're talking knowing our minds to a level that even more than the best therapist would show you.
So the level more than the best therapist would show you means a set of practices that are not just about talking to each other or talking about what's on our mind. It goes deeper than that.
Well, yeah,
it starts with noticing.
What I'm meaning is that the way Buddha talks about the mind. You know, I remember a few years, in 2003, one of these conferences that Dalai Lama's been participating in for the last 20 years or something called Mind and Life. And they've mostly been published. They're great. He meets with all the best brains in the West. You know, the neuro this is and the biologists and the psychiatrists. And they're really amazing, all about the nature of the universe and the mind, and especially the mind. And there's been lots of wonderful experiments lately on the basis of that work in, you know, people doing, you know, what do you call them? Looking at the brain of these meditators.
Brain waves and all that stuff. Yeah.
That's exactly
right.
I heard a thing
about... somebody took the Dalai Lama's happiest monks and measured their brain waves trying to get everybody else to go into those patterns.
That's right. So anyway, this conference in 2003 was on the topic of what is the capacity of the human mind to concentrate. So clearly the Western, the materialists, based upon their assertion that mind is the brain and therefore the conceptuality, which is what we have from day to day, right? In our daily life, we think and we have feelings. That's what the mind is. So according to their findings, 6 seconds is about the maximum anybody could concentrate, depending, I don't know, whatever their definition was.
The average person or anybody?
I don't remember. But the point is the Dalai Lama and his mob, these Buddhists, who are basing their findings on the assertion that your consciousness is not your brain, that second, that the conceptuality is just the tip of the iceberg, and that we all have the potential, utilizing these marvelous skills called, you know, these psychological skills called meditation, can access unbelievably refined, subtle levels of consciousness. And this is what the Buddhists have been doing for thousands of years, and the Hindus before them, and that it's all mind, not some abstract, weirdo spirit part of you, you know, but it's your mind, that these techniques can enable you to access, to go beyond your conceptual and your sensory, which we think is all there is in the West, and that their findings were that you can concentrate for months on end. So clearly, you know, you've got two different models here and two enormously different findings. And this is the Buddha's point, that at the level we function now, which is conceptual and sensory and emotional, right? You wake up in the morning, you go to sleep. The rest of it's a bit weird. We don't really understand dreams. It doesn't fit much with the brain model. I don't know. I don't think so. But the Buddha's saying that's just the tip of the iceberg. And you can go to deeper levels, and you need to in the long term to be able to really deconstruct the nonsense, really undo this watertight way that we live life that we don't even notice. But we've got to start where we are, which is conscious. But then utilizing these techniques, you can go to more subtle levels and see your mind at a much more profound level at its root, and then get rid of all the nonsense. It's a very practical thing, mystical.
We're talking to Robina Korten, who is teaching a course called Transforming Problems into Happiness, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at Body of Santa Fe, which, by the way, can be found on the internet at, I think it's bodyofsantafe.com.
There you go.
This is something, and I know there's probably some rules against your talking about yourself too much, but this is a process that you have engaged in. The process that you're talking about.
Being a Buddhist in general, working on my mind, yeah. I haven't done much meditating, concentrating.
You haven't done much meditating?
No.
What have you been doing?
Working on my mind at the level I'm at right now.
What does that look like?
That means transforming problems.
Well, okay, so you get up in the morning, what do you do?
No, I do practices. I have 2 or 3 hours every day of practices that I do. And depending, I mean, for years and years, I'd be up at 4:30 in the morning and I'd sit for 3 hours and do my meditating, which includes lots of prayers, mantras, visualizations, prostrations, all kinds of practices in the Tibetan tradition. Big sort of super practices. So for years and years, I was doing that. But right now, at the moment, I've got all my prayers are on my iPod shuffle. 3 hours of 4 hours of prayers and practices. So these days I'm into action mode, so I walk. I walk around San Francisco and all the homeless people 2 to 3 hours a day, walking, doing my prayers out loud to myself, so I don't sit and with my eyes closed. So that's me at the moment.
She's holding up an iPod, ladies and gentlemen, and it's
a shuffle.
An iPod shuffle.
Right.
And so the prayers are coming out in no particular order.
Oh no, they're all in order. I've recited all my prayers to myself, and then I put my earphones in and I walk around and I say them.
Do they
myself.
Think that you're nuts?
People probably think I'm nuts, yeah. I mean, I don't always say them out loud. But that's what I do these days. And I do my practices, but I'm not in a sitting, closing my eyes mode.
And so when you look at yourself, I mean, you have always done liberation work of some kind. And we're going to talk about in
okay.
a moment the Liberation mm-hmm. Prison Project that you are deeply involved in. But you've been involved in women's liberation and,
sure.
and racial politics and
mm-hmm.
so on
mm-hmm.
before you discovered Buddhist practice.
Yep.
What was similar and what was different in the way you did radical politics in the 60s versus what you're doing now?
It's the way I see it all, the view, how I see things.
And how's that different?
And this is the point, I think, all the way, the more we see it, I don't know, the more it seems reasonable, that everything isn't how you see it. So I was a Catholic. You know, brought up a Catholic and wanted to be a nun, wanted to be a priest actually, but they wouldn't let me because I think I must have been so little that intellectually I didn't get it. Because as soon as I went to Mass, I knew it was my job, I had my name on it, you know. And then I thought, all right, I'll be a nun. So when I was 12, I was on my knees in the kitchen begging my mother to let me be a nun like Saint Therese of Lisieux. She was my great hero. She was an extreme nun. I'm an extremist, you see. So my mother, I cried, of course. And then 20 years later, my mother cried when I became a Buddhist nun. Anyway, she really did cry. But I think just my own evolution, I've always wanted happiness. We all want happiness, right? And I tried different methods. But I also wanted to know the truth. And I know it sounds noble, but I really did. From the time I can remember, I always wanted to understand why things were the way they were. And it never went in scientific terms for me. It always went internal, like philosophical or psychological or political. So I think by the time I was 15 and I discovered Billie Holiday and Miles Davis, my religious aspirations became sort of social. And then I gave up sex when I was quite old, actually. No, I gave up going to Mass when I was 19, made a conscious decision, goodbye God, hello boys, and then drugs and whatever, you know. So I think when I was sort of raving hippie, I went to England in the late 60s, and so I'm always looking for what was the cause of everything. So clearly, in normal terms, you look at the outside world. So for me, I was totally into the hippie philosophy, and as far as I was concerned, all the straight people, and that view was the cause of all suffering. And then that kind of gradually moved into political activity, and it was mainly in England, the at the time of the Black Panthers and the Soledad Brothers and all that. I was involved with some groups around that. So then it was all the white people, who are the enemies.
And of which that, you were one.
Well, indeed. And then gradually that moved to, first left politics, sorry, kind of all the rich people were the cause of suffering and all the, and the poor people were the victims. Then the black politics, and then it was feminist. So then it was all the male people who were the problem. So it was always for me looking for, I was serious, looking for the cause of suffering, looking for a way to understand the universe.
And you add more and more groups and pretty soon there's nobody left.
Well, that's
left.
The point. I had no one left but Robina, by this point. And I was like, by now I was 29, then I was doing martial arts and moving, I think, very consciously again towards what I would call a spiritual path. And I think then when I was 30-something, I bumped into these Tibetans, So that's... So the thing for me is that I was always looking for why things were. I was wanting a worldview. And all I can say is, so far, so good, was the one that's the Buddhist one. And in particular, I happen to like the way the Tibetans approach it. That's all. So that's been what I've been doing these last 30 years or something, studying the philosophy. And so, okay, where it comes to practice, this is the thing, I think there's many ways of practicing, and I think a cliched idea we have of what practice is you close your eyes and you sort of quieten your mind. Well, that's one of the many techniques. But when it comes down to it, as I mentioned before, one way of seeing it is that what you're doing is changing the way you think, radically changing the way you think, because everything comes down to how you see things. So anger, which sounds like a joke, to say it's a viewpoint, but this is the point I'm making. The more you see your mind, the more you deconstruct the emotional level, which is the gross level, which is what I've been doing in my life. Anger's been one of my main ones. So I can say the differences now in what I'm doing are based upon my having changed my mind in a radical way, not just suffocated, but learn to see the anger, to see the emotional junk, and slowly, by being my own therapist, going deeper and deeper and learning to literally cease the usual emotional responses. I mean, you change literally, emotionally, and therefore intellectually. You change. And so now I can say I don't have that kind of anger. I'm not angry, but I haven't lost my action mode. I haven't lost the action energy. So you don't chuck the baby out with the bathwater. This is what I'm seeing.
I would imagine, yes, that when in your work of teaching prisoners, working with prisoners, that having dealt with anger is something that you can give them.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, for sure, I remember one of the very first people I visited, this young this Mexican, was the very first person who, how the whole thing started was about 12 years ago, and this Mexican-American guy from Los Angeles who'd been in gangs all his life, Arturo, he wrote to our magazine, the one I was editing, the Buddhist magazine, part of the organization I'm part of, the FPMT.
And
he'd found a book.
A book.
That's right.
Which is another reason to support prison libraries.
Absolutely. Oh, my God, yeah. And we're feeling the impact of that, too, that business with the federal prisons right now. So Arturo had read this book, and he was moved by the talk of compassion. So he found our address and wrote. And then that's now grown into this project that we have in San Francisco, 8 full-time workers, a budget of $30,000, $35,000 a month. We have letters. We get letters from 700-800 prisoners every month. We have 150 volunteer teachers around the world who write to prisoners. We have this whole system, We're also in Australia, Mexico, Spain, Mongolia. Anyway, what am I saying? I forget what I'm saying.
teaching the cessation of anger and Arturo.
Okay. So I remember his friend wrote. The second person who ever wrote was his friend, Francisco. And he was, when I first met him, I remember at the end of the meeting, and I was behaving very nicely, he said to me, "Robina, I'm so happy you've got a wild side." So I think this is something that reminded me too, because when I was first getting involved with spiritual things, inevitably you start getting again involved in spiritual things, meditation. You kind of get this fairly cliched idea of what you think a meditator is, what you think a peaceful person is. So you walk around pretending, you're completely inauthentic. And a friend of mine held my hand and she said, "Robina, what's happened? You've lost your energy." And I remember then really strongly realizing you've got to learn just to be who you are, but make that better. So you can be a big, loud, fat person or a small, light, soft person, but when you change your mind, we can see we've all got different personalities. You don't just become a clone of a mindful, peaceful person who walks quietly. That's absurd, You become who you are.
But lots of people do that.
Well, it's ridiculous. It's like we've got to go in deeper. We're always inauthentic in the beginning in anything we do, but we've got to keep moving, keep going further. And this is why I'm always delighted by the Dalai Lama. I mean, he talks fast, he walks fast, he does things fast, he's very dynamic, and he's not your cliched idea of what you think, I remember one time in Los Angeles, a person said to him about something about mindful, and he said, "I don't want to know about peaceful, mindful." He said, "I want a man of action, long-term patience, that's what I want." So anyway, the point is, with working with people, for sure, that, yeah, of course, well, knowing it yourself, then you can help others, can't you?
So when you work with prisoners, how do they differ as students from students out in the outside world?
Well, one way, absolutely no different. We're all human. We're all exactly the same with the same problems. The difference is they're just more desperate because their houses are disgusting. They've got lousy food. They've got no friends. They have no money. They can't even pick your nose in peace, you know, in many of the places. So they've just got these very dire situations. And inevitably, therefore, the anger and the depression are more intense. So everything is at a more intense level. I mean, we're basically a Buddhist center, but we get, you know, every month in all the different places we're doing it, it's like we're getting a knock on our door from 1,000 desperate people every single month, and we help every one of them, and we pay to do it because we don't have a choice. And that's something that I found with the prison project. I mean, we're all suffering, there's no question. If you look at the second kind of suffering the Buddha talks about is the kind that we've all got outside of prison. You know, we don't think we're suffering. But this is interesting. I know when Arturo turned 21, he was 18 when he wrote to me. He turned 21, and he's in one of these prisons that's called, especially in California, but now it's everywhere. They call them security housing units, where they've got permanent lockdown, as they call it, where you're in your cells all the time.
Because they can't even go outside?
1 hour. No, there's many now. It was considered against human rights when this one started more than 20 years ago, but now it's the basis of a lot of the prisons in this country and even now in others as well. It's because of the intensity, say, in California, of the gang violence, which is incredible, I can't tell you. So to keep the troublemakers off the main yards, they have this permanent lockdown situation. And in this one prison called Pelican Bay, I don't know, there's 2,000 of the 5,000 prisoners are in this situation. And many of these guys will never leave that. So they've got this small cell, two bunk cells, and this units where they never get out. There's no light, there's no air, and you have 1 hour walking up and down in another cell on your own. So it's kind of interesting. So Arturo's in that, right? And when he turned 21, and in that cell they're allowed to have the inside of a pen, because you might use the outside to stab your cellie up above you, you know, 10 books, very often less, and not all of them have 1 hour exercise every day. Maybe it's only 3 days a week, you know. So it's kind of intense. So anyway, Arturo Lamazopa wrote to him, and he said this. He said something like this. He said, "Your prison is nothing in comparison with the inner prison of ordinary people. The prison of attachment, the prison of pride, the prison of anger, the prison of depression." And I mean, these guys, somehow, what I'm seeing, the people we know in prison, they really kind of know that. But it is disgusting. These houses where they live are disgusting, you know. And I have to say, most American prisons are worse than any Australian prison I've seen, just for example, not to mention other countries. But somehow, when you start, this is the Buddhist deal, when you start to know your mind, you really do see that is the nightmare, that is the hell realm that you're living in, you know. And so I can see with these guys, I mean, so many examples, but I can really see with so many of these people in prison that we're working with, using these tools, you know, that I'm trying to work with too, that they understand this deeply. And so they know the only thing they've got to change is their mind. They can't do anything else. I mean, there's this great example, a woman I read about in a yoga magazine. I didn't meet her. She was on death row, 17 years, got out eventually, but she was innocent. And she said something like this: "I decided the only thing I could change was my mind, you know." And then she said, "I decided," and this is the point I'm making before, that it all comes down to viewpoint, which sounds like a joke. She said, "I decided I am not a prisoner, I'm a monk. I'm not in a cell, I'm in a cave." So she proceeded to make the most of her 17 years, you know.
And what happened to her?
She got out eventually.
When she got out, and this is...
I don't know about anything about the rest of them. That was just her story. I remember these quotes, you know.
Do you think there's a relationship in a case like that, maybe not the specific case, but things like this, between getting out and liberating oneself from the inside?
Well, that's interesting. That's a very interesting point, actually. When you go more deeply into the whole business about karma, we do a certain kind of practice every day that we call purification. And it's really a psychological process, like most of the Buddhist stuff is, you know. It's changing the way you see things. And so one of the first steps in this process we call the four R's, the first step is regret. So it's kind of like owning responsibility for the fact that you did something. And then you regret it because you don't want the suffering, because you don't want the repercussions from that. So it really is like compassion for yourself. The second step involves compassion for others. So the way they teach about karma, they say that everything we experience is the fruit of what we've done, all the happiness as well. And so one way of purifying the stuff that's happening to you is by regretting what you did in the past to cause it, which is awfully logical. So don't. I wouldn't be surprised if you're dealing with your mind now, hugely. I can see it myself. Taking responsibility, giving up blame and anger, and then changing yourself. This can help impact upon the external circumstances. For sure, I feel that. This is fitting with the teachings about karma anyway.
It must be so hard for people who are in prison who didn't do anything wrong.
Like this woman.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because it's harder to see how being there is the fruit of their actions.
That's right.
Or the same with the people in Iraq.
That's right. But that's where you go. In order to really look at the big... In order to really get what Buddha's saying at the deep level, you've got to hypothesize a continuity of consciousness. If we all began in our mother's womb, if the materialists are right in asserting that your parents actually made you and the Buddha's wrong, well, then Buddhism's ridiculous. Just cancel it out, you know. I mean, some tools are very practical there. But if you take the big picture, the whole of Buddhism collapses if our mothers really did make us or if God made us. So you've got to take that as a hypothesis.
So when you take that as a hypothesis and you see that there's this continuity of
consciousness yeah.
then... Yeah. The innocent victims of gang violence or somebody who's on death row for no reason, there is a reason.
Yeah, there's no such thing as an innocent victim in Buddhist terms. But what's interesting is the same with all the happiness. But you check. We will say, why do bad things happen to me? But you check. We never say, why do good things happen to me? We just assume it's our human right and we greedily take them. But if you want a logical reason for why bad things happen, you have to have a logical reason for why a good thing happens.
People do care about that. I've thought about that a great deal and talked about it with friends. It's like, what did we do to be so lucky to be here?
No, it's true. You're right. There you go. Well, the Buddha says the explanation is your past actions. We set ourselves up. We are the creators of ourselves. There's no such concept of an innocent, or good luck or bad luck, if you like, in the big picture. But that doesn't mean, therefore, you think, oh, well, they all deserve it, because we're all in the same boat, all experiencing the fruit of our past actions.
When you have a nice life, as probably many of the people listening to this program right now do, is there a responsibility that comes with that?
Of course there is. That's called compassion. You know, the wisdom wing is put yourself together, sort yourself out, and, you know, so I'm using the Buddhist thing here, understand the nuts and bolts of why, which you use as the basis to put yourself together. Then you put your money where your mouth is, and now you get out there and help others. That's the point. That's the bodhisattva wing, for sure. That is your responsibility, finally.
We're talking to Rubina Korten. She's a Tibetan Buddhist nun over the last 25 years, and she's teaching a course at Body of Santa Fe this weekend called Transforming Problems into Happiness. It's on Friday evening and then Saturday and Sunday. And to contact Body, you can write on the email to info@bodyofsantafe.com, or you can go to the website bodyofsantafe.com, or you can also call 986-0362.
And also, the center that invited me is the center that I'm part of, the organization I'm part of, Thubten Norbu Ling, and they're working with Body on this course. They're the ones who invited me. I've got teachings all this week, I think.
That's right, and they also have a website, which is TNLSF, which is Thubten Norbu Ling Santa Fe.
That's right. .org. Exactly.
So, what is the main focus of your work? Is it basically the prison project these days?
It's a part of it. I've got different jobs. One is to run the prison project, but I've got really good people working, so I don't need to be there all the time, but I'm kind of involved with it closely. Of course I am. And I bring in the money, so I've got to be part of that.
Do you have enough resources to do that work?
Well, all the years we were doing it, the first few years, we never had any money, ever. So this is something interesting. We really had to develop an incredibly brave attitude, which is sort of counterintuitive, really. You know, normally speaking, if you want, in your own life or whatever, if you check your purse and you see there's no money, you say, I can't do that thing, don't you? But we had to learn to say, we will do it, and then we'll find the money, because the need is so huge. And when these letters come on your desk, it's not possible you can turn your back. It's not possible. So somehow we learned to be very courageous, to do the work, and I think for months on end, I'd never know where the money would come from. But here we are, surviving still. Then a couple of years ago, someone gave me some money, which I've invested, and we used that cash. So it's very fortunate. But we still continue to receive donations, and we need to so we can grow. But it's always come from donations. But I've never done any begging. I can't stand all that begging mode. I always figure if you do your job well...
I thought that was a Buddhist monk's job, is taking the begging bowl out.
Well, that's all right. Well, no, I know it is, you know. But I think coming with that, I've been talking about that lately to our center here, you know, you can really get the sense of entitlement. Oh, we're a Buddhist center. People should give to us. But actually... Lama Zabrimche said one time to somebody, don't think of receiving, think of giving. So that's the bodhisattva practice, the practice of wanting to give, and we've been forced to have to do that with the prison project. So you get very brave with that, I think, and that's how we've survived until now, I think. It's 12 years or something.
And there's certainly not a relationship between the amount of good you can do and the amount of money you have.
No, it's true.
And I had an interesting conversation with a journalist this weekend who said that basically the people, when he goes to great big television stations with huge amounts of money, they're the ones who haven't read his book and don't have the slightest idea what he's talking about. Uh-huh. And little ragtag operations are full of people who do a much better job.
Oh, absolutely. And you look at the Mother Teresa of the world. If you want to do something that badly, you'll do it, and then the money comes. I know that for sure. I'm absolutely certain. You know? And in your daily life, I think it's the same. You have to have this break. You develop first in the mind the attitude that you want to do it and that you want to give. And then it comes. It comes. And I mean, you've got to do the work to make it come. So that's one of the parts of my jobs, the prison project. And then I think also edit books for Wisdom Publications as part of our organization. Then also, we're working at the moment on a big project in San Francisco using commerce to support nonprofit, because I just never like this nonprofit begging mode, like I said. So it's become huge, actually, $700 million, actually. It's become ridiculously big. Began with the idea for me of using, developing a Buddhist book cafe. I mean, look at this place, full of people. But you look at a Buddhist center at the same time, I bet you it hasn't got full of people. Because we all might need meditation, but we all prefer a cup of coffee. So why not bring the cup of coffee? And that'll be the basis of getting the money that runs the Buddhist center. Why not? It's a very practical mode.
And then you can watch what the caffeine does to your consciousness.
There you go. So I think we like commerce in the West. So I've always had this idea, for years it's been growing, to use commerce to support nonprofit. And so it's now become this insanely big idea that's moving forward. We're building condominiums and building and having a hotel and a restaurant and a vegetarian thing and a spa and a childcare place and car parking to fully support a Buddhist center, housing for 200 homeless people, the prison project, a monastery for 100 monks and nuns. What else? Something like that. And just this kind of plan is there and moving forward with that, and the team is developing, taking it one step at a time. So I'm having fun doing that.
One of your websites is liberationprisonproject.org. Yeah. People can find out more about the prison work on that. What about this attaching to commerce? Is there a place where people can find out about
that
work?
Now, that's called Sherab Plaza, and we haven't got a website yet. It's still in the mind and working and dealing with people and getting it set up. So eventually it will.
Well, it's been wonderful having you here on the air with us, Rubina Curtin. Anything that you want to leave our listeners with in the last minute before we go?
I think know that things can change and really have confidence in your own potential and never give up. That's what I'd like to say.
Rubina Curtin is a Tibetan Buddhist nun. She's been doing this for over 25 years. Her class is called Transforming Problems into Happiness, Teachings by Venerable Rubina Curtin. It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at Body of Santa Fe. Friday, it's at 6:30 in the evening. Saturday at 2:30 in the afternoon for 2 hours, and then again at 6:30 in the evening. And Sunday at 2:30 in the afternoon. Do people have to go to all of them?
You can come anytime you like, yeah.
Okay, and all of that, Body of Santa Fe, 986-0362. And you can go to the website, bodyofsantafe.com. Thank you so much for spending all this time with us.
Thank you, my dear. Very happy to be here.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org, or you can leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features Artist of the Month, Michel Camilo, and Giants of Jazz features Oscar Peterson. The show is dedicated in memory of Joe Joyner. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte, and we will see you tomorrow. And in fact, the wonderful Ron Bloomberg will be joining us. That and Bioneers and much, much more here on Santa Fe's only public radio station, KSFR. Hasta la vista. Ciao.